Oh, g'day, Tone. It's Pete here. Listen, did I get your message correctly? You want me to do an intro for your story, Breakfast in Dubbo, from Lolly Scramble? Look, do you remember the Brown album those years ago? Tone, I never got paid for that. So frankly, mate, I'd rather my voice wasn't heard on the album. I'll make that clear to you, okay? Sorry, mate. Pete Smith speaking.
Somewhere between Toowoomba and Dubbo, the whole bus turned against me. All the passengers and even the driver, a pit bull in short shorts and long socks who'd run out of banter 2 km out of Brisbane.
I hope you're f***ing happy, Martin, he snarled, his trademark wit exhausted.
I was seated a metre behind him, but out of habit he said it into the PA, giving the other 60 passengers another reason to hate me.
You're not helping, I whispered. No, you're not helping, he informed the bus.
Which hurt because I am nothing, if not helpful. 7 hours earlier, everything had been going swimmingly. I had 2 seats to myself at the front, which gave me a ringside view of the driver, Les Mackey, in action. His monologue was well polished and he worked the microphone like a leathery Wayne Newton. He had a droll twist or lewd variation on every place name we encountered, Aboriginal or otherwise. Only Indooroopilly seemed to defeat him, although he may have been momentarily awed by the majesty of Indooroopilly shopping town. He wouldn't have been the first. As the place names became fewer and farther between, the scenery out the window changed from outer suburbs to flat, dry plains with the same blackened tree flitting past every 15 seconds, Hanna-Barbera style. It was here that Les's material dried up, but from nowhere he produced 2 buckets of lollies and passed them back. Amidst the staggered crackle of lolly papers, conversation started breaking out all over, and within seconds I no longer had the luxury of an empty seat beside me.
Mind if I sit here?
The voice came from a compact, sensible woman in a Ken Donish parachute ensemble. She introduced herself as Marilyn Tomes from the Sunshine Coast and explained that her identically attired husband was falling asleep and she'd rather he had 2 seats upon which to do so. She soon spotted my New Zealand accent and this prompted her to reveal that she herself knew several New Zealanders and that every last one of them was, get this, on the dole. I considered my response carefully.
I should tell you that up until midnight next Tuesday, I myself am what you might call a Kiwi doll bludger.
Really?
Oh, pardon me, but you seem like a nice enough person. These ones by us, they're not exactly out there looking for work, if you get my meaning. They seem to spend most of their time lolling about on the beach, and there's always the smell of you-know-what drifting over the balcony.
Roast lamb.
Marijuana, she enunciated.
That sounds like New Zealanders all right.
I'm sure they're quite harmless. They're simply unmotivated and frankly incomprehensible.
How do you mean?
One of them's always asking me if I want anything from the dairy.
The milk bar?
Apparently. Where do you milk your cows? At the sandwich shop?
I'd heard this joke many times before, but I was impressed by the way she'd substituted sandwich shop for the usual clumsy repetition of milk bar. She'd made it work, but I had no way of knowing whether the modification was her own. Tell me, I inquired, do they wear jandals?
Oh, yes, and jerseys. It's a whole nother world over there.
We paused for an announcement by Les to the effect that there might be a very amusing sign coming up round the next bend, unless it's been taken down, which it had. After 30 seconds, he gave up trying to remember what it had said and instead passed back some flake bars. Marilyn wrestled one free of its wrapper and resumed her inquiries.
How long have you been on the, unemployed?
5 weeks, but from next week I'm cutting articles out of newspapers in Melbourne for $200 a week.
That's a job.
So they tell me.
And they need someone from interstate?
I'm a specialist.
And you're on your own?
My girlfriend's back in Brisbane. She's the one with the proper job.
What does she do?
She makes tiny cardboard buildings for an architectural model maker.
Goodness! Is there much call for that?
Oh, sure. Brisbane was in the middle of a miniature real estate boom. She couldn't make them fast enough.
And she's coming down with you?
Yes, in a couple of months. Marilyn chewed on this for a while.
Right, so she's giving up her job as an architectural model maker to support you in your dream to cut articles out of newspapers.
It was like something I would have said, but less smart-arsey. Basically, yes, we're hoping the cutting out will lead to bigger things.
Despite the good humour, I could tell that Marilyn wasn't really sure about me. I did, in my early 20s, have about me the air of a geekish loner. My tragic collarless shirt and new romantic-era trousers had already drawn several disapproving looks from the largely dressed-for-tourism horde behind me. Her husband, Tobin, who'd made his money in extensions, had recently hit 65, and although Marilyn herself was still in her mid-50s, the pair had opted for early retirement and now spent their days roaming the country in buses and trains, subsisting on complimentary nuts and the endless, endless Devonshire teas. I couldn't imagine why anyone would voluntarily choose a tour bus as a way of traversing the country over and over again. It seemed to me that if you were always on buses, you'd eventually end up on the news in some of that horrible footage of half a coach on its side and what looks like an entire retirement village strewn across the highway. At some point in the conversation, Marilyn happened to mention that there was a movie schedule for that evening. Of course. That explained the three TV sets clinging to the ceiling equidistantly along the aisle. "Do you know what it's going to be?" I blurted, more excited by this prospect than I had been by any of the relentlessly magnificent scenery we'd been carving through for the last 6 hours.
"I hear we get to vote," said Marilyn.
"Vote? What are the choices?"
"You'd have to ask Mr. Mackey."
I didn't want to appear too desperate, but the sad fact is that I'm one of those people who, when boarding a plane, will have gone through the magazine and found out what the movie's going to be before most of the other passengers have reached their seats. As the Iron Bird begins its wondrous ascent and children cleave to the portholes to marvel at the ongoing miracle of flight, I'm the one going, "Krippendorf's Tribe? How is that a special event presentation?" But a movie on a bus? That I'd never seen. A couple of hours and several opportunities to purchase ammunition passed us by, and then Marilyn excused herself and returned to her assigned seat.
"Might see you later,"
she whispered, squeezing in next to her unconscious husband. "Nice to meet you," I replied. Although what I was thinking was, what's the movie going to be? As soon as the Kendone twins had been reunited, I tapped Les Mackey on the shoulder.
"Excuse me, Mr. Mackey, I was wondering what the story is with the video tonight."
"Were you just? How does it work? We vote?"
"That's right. That way there's no arguments."
"And how many titles are there to choose from?"
"There's four."
"Can I ask what they are?"
"Well, that might give you an unfair advantage."
"What advantage? I'd still only have one vote."
"Listen, I've had trouble before. People start lobbying each other for support for their title. Factions form. It can get quite ugly. Best you just find out tonight with everyone else."
"Can I ask what genres?"
"No."
"Are they recent?"
"Leave it."
"Okay, sure. We'll find out tonight.
Go back to your seat."
"No worries."
"There's a funny sign coming up."
"Great."
"Good."
"Sorry about that."
"Fine.
Is one of them Ghostbus
seat?"
With a rustle of synthetic fibres, Marilyn's husband Tobin settled his substantial self in the spare seat.
"Tony, is it? My wife tells me you're from across the ditch."
"Afraid so."
"She's nodded off, so I thought you wouldn't mind if I..."
"Not at all. Milky Bar?"
"Milky Bar? No, sorry. There's no end to the bloody snacks, is there? I reckon I'll go spare if he sends back any more refreshments."
I noted again that Tobin was wearing the sort of elasticated clothing that made this kind of trip so much more bearable, and there was no doubting his name because it was felt-penned on an oval-shaped introducing sticker peeling slowly from his billowing trackie jacket. "What's with the sticker?"
"Oh, right,"
he laughed, swatting it off with his enormous paw.
"That's from dancing with the oldies at the resort last night. Not that I call myself an oldie, but you got to get involved in the entertainments."
"Speaking of which, have you heard about the movie?"
"Yeah, look, I'll be sleeping through it, whatever it is. Bloody rubbish, probably. The last two of these I've been on, it's been Flashdance or some bloody nonsense."
"Will you still be voting?"
"Oh, load of bloody carry-on, that's what it is. Who wants to watch bloody films when you're travelling through this kind of country? You might as well stay home if you just want to watch TV."
"Right, so you're not a film buff then?"
"Oh, don't get me wrong. I'm all for it. Me and her, we go to the pictures a fair bit, but there's so much bloody swearing and language these days, effing this and blinding that, we end up walking out half the time."
"What was the last one where that happened?"
"Caligula."
"Caligula? Why did you go to that?"
"Oh, it looked historical."
Bob Guccione's Caligula was indeed historical, but not for the reasons Tobin was referring to.
"You know, I thought it might have been another I, Claudius, but it was all bloody tits and genitalia, people's bits swinging everywhere. It was like a smoker's night kind of a film, much too blue for us, I'm afraid. I was very surprised to see Sir John Gielgud's name in the credits. Of course, you couldn't see him for Ghoulies."
"Maybe we'll be getting that tonight."
"I bloody hope not."
The possibility that the selection could end up being something as dire as Flashdance was really starting to weigh on me.
Who cares what it is anyway? There's more to life than bloody films.
Mr. Tomes, if you're not going to take part, could I perhaps enlist your support in the vote?
Oh, I don't know about that. What am I voting for?
Well, we don't know yet, but every vote is going to count. Do you know if your wife will have any preferences?
You're having a lend, aren't you?
No, I just think if we're going to have a film, it should be the best one. My voice trailed off as I realised how mad I sounded.
Don't worry about it, mate. It's only bloody video.
You're right, I know.
It's not the be-all and end-all.
No, of course not. Forget about it. I won't mention it again. Besides, chances were all four titles would be shit. Then it would just be a lesser of four evils vote. As the sun began to make itself scarce, we pulled over to a rest area and Les Mackey crabbed his way up the aisle and into the curtained-off zone where the second driver slept and presumably guarded the videotapes. Moments later, he emerged with a battered plastic tape caddy containing the all-important selections in the popular VHS format.
Got your pen and paper, everybody?
He beamed with the largesse of a man about to reveal the contents of a very fat will.
Tony, you writing these down?
I don't need to, Mr. Mackey. Just hit me with the four titles.
All right. Here we go, folks. These are the four titles you'll be asked to vote on, all of them courtesy of our very good friends at Video Kingdom New Farm. First up, we've got...
This was it. Please don't let it be anything with Dom DeLuise.
Beverly Hills Cop with Eddie Murphy.
Not bad. Not bad at all. A crowd pleaser. Remember, this was the mid-80s, in those magic months before the Golden Child and all those leather suits ended Eddie's incredible winning streak. We were off to a good start.
Pretty funny stuff, but a fair bit of gunplay and swearing.
What? Don't say that. In fact, don't say anything. Just read out the titles.
Next up, we've got Excalibur with... Look, I don't recognise any of these names, but it's a King Arthur kind of a thing. Pretty bloodthirsty, if I recall, but the music's not bad. There's a great bit with the theme from the Old Spice commercial.
What the f*** are you saying?
And a little bit of what I'd describe as tasteful nudity.
Good.
And a brief sequence of rutting.
What? Rutting? Who uses the word rutting? That in itself is frankly more disturbing than anything in Excalibur.
And I should warn you, there's one bit where a large black bird pecks the eyeball out of the skull of a corpse that's dangling from a tree.
Except perhaps for that. Between the pecking and the rutting, Les had pretty much eliminated Excalibur from contention. I could feel it in the air. This crowd wanted something with Bette Midler screaming at her husband, not corpses dangling from trees and the theme from the Old Spice commercial.
Selection number three is one I haven't seen myself.
Good. Hopefully there'll be no editorialising.
It's called Six Pack.
Les scanned the cover.
What? What the hell is Six Pack?
With Kenny Rogers as...
Did he just say Kenny Rogers?
A washed-up stock car driver who finds himself in a mess the size of Texas when he inherits six mischievous orphans on the day of the big race.
Did he just say orphans? Mischievous orphans? And was there something earlier about stock car racing?
That's sun-tested waters, that one.
Right, so obviously we're not going to be watching that one. What's selection number four?
As is number four, which is a documentary.
Documentary? I hadn't considered the possibility of a documentary.
Called This Is Spinal Tap.
Holy bejesus, Spinal Tap? I didn't even know you could get it on video yet. I'd seen This Is Spinal Tap in a one-off screening at Brisbane University the year before. There were about 20 of us in the audience, and by the end we had all laughed so hard and so much we could literally laugh no more. We staggered from the theatre in a daze. It was the funniest film any of us had ever seen, and the chances of anyone on the bus having seen it were virtually nil. It had never gotten a proper release, and most people, if they knew of it at all, thought it was an actual documentary about an actual heavy metal band. Les Mackey was sitting on gold. Spinal Tap would bring the house down, and it was pointless to even entertain the possibility of it being one of the other three. Not even Beverly Hills Cop, which surely everyone had seen, could compete with Spinal Tap. It was perfect. It simply had to be. And they all f***ing voted for Six Pack. Perhaps I shouldn't have made the speech, but I wasn't the one who started it.
As soon as Les had finished his spiel, a rather high-pitched woman right up the back stepped into the aisle and declared that the Kenny Rogers one was the only one that sounded fit for family viewing. Several elderly women chorused their support, but what they all failed to mention was the fact that, remarkably, there were no children on the bus. We were all adults here, and surely we could handle the odd motherfucker if it meant getting to watch a movie that was at least halfway decent. The call for family values was echoed up and down the pensioner-controlled tube with the odd half-hearted Beverly Hills Cop thrown in for good measure. No one wanted Excalibur, but to my astonishment, there was one call for Spinal Tap from a solitary beardo four rows back. I had at least one ally, but nowhere enough support to swing the vote. There was no other option. I'd have to make a speech. Les, if I could just say a few words, I ventured.
Who are you?
Squawked an old bird down the front. I'm a passenger, I announced, seeing off any possible support I may have had right there at the outset. And before we all decide,
I think we've decided, haven't we?
I'd just like to put in a word for Spinal Tap. Booze. There were booze.
It's a documentary,
someone spat in apparent disgust. No, it's not, I attempted. It's a comedy, a really funny comedy disguised as a documentary.
What piffle,
someone snorted. I realised I made it sound too highfalutin.
Who's in it?
Shit. I couldn't say Christopher Guest or one of either Lenny or Squiggy. Meathead's in it, I said in clear desperation.
Who?
Meathead from Archie Bunker, and he directed it? That didn't help. Billy Crystal's in one scene. I was flailing.
Who?
This was before When Harry Met Sally. The next comment, seemingly from Norman Bates's mother, cleared up the confusion.
The gay one from Soap,
she hissed, triggering a wave of disapproving tongue clicks. I had one final gambit. Patrick McNee's in it? You know, Steed from The Avengers?
What, in a heavy metal documentary?
Said a sceptical fat bloke.
You're talking through your arse, mate.
He was quickly admonished for his arse. Listen to me, I pleaded. It's incredibly funny. It'll be so worth it, I promise you.
Six-pack! Let's have six-pack! Kenny Rogers!
I fully expected someone to start a chorus of You Picked a Fine Time to Leave Me, Lucille. Hey, I like Kenny Rogers, I said as convincingly as I could. But don't you just get the feeling that six-pack is going to suck? Apparently nobody did. But I had nothing to lose. I mean, does anyone remember it coming out at the movies?
I don't remember Spinal Crap coming out at the movies,
contributed someone, and sadly Spinal Crap did get a laugh. How about this, I suggested, my welcome long since worn out. We put on Spinal Tap, and if after 10 minutes nobody's laughing, we'll turn it off and put on Six Pack.
But what about the language,
said the original speaker, returning to her theme. There's a little bit of language, sure, but it is funny, and as there's no children here, lick my love pump. It wasn't a helpful interjection, and I couldn't help but notice it came from the mouth of my one supporter. He was grinning from ear to ear, but Les Mackey wasn't amused.
What did you just say, young man?
He repeated it, adding, it's one of the funniest lines from the movie, from Spinal Tap. Cue mischievous orphans. During my pathetic entreaty, I'd seen Tobin and Marilyn Tomes slowly but surely lose all respect for me. To them, I was now the mad guy who tried to make us watch a disgusting documentary about c***ing. I slumped sulkily in my seat as Les fired up the video in order that Kenny Rogers and his wholesome brood might cleanse us all of the filth that thin man with the New Zealand accent had ushered aboard this otherwise family-friendly perambulant. Six Pack began predictably enough with tracking difficulties. After Les had pulled over, fixed it and rewound, we were treated to the title sequence a second time. This featured Kenny in a hairstyle so altogether ludicrous it just had to be real, piloting a pickup truck through the countryside. As he drives, Kenny's character, the washed-up stock car driver, listens to the radio, which is playing a song by Kenny Rogers. For a brief hopeful moment, I expected that the film would feature a scene where Kenny's character and the real Kenny meet up via the magic of early 80s split screen. But no, it remained an unexplained movie coincidence that a song by Kenny Rogers was being enjoyed by an anonymous everyman who happened to look exactly like him. As one unsurprising occurrence blandly followed another, there descended upon the bus the warm, calming glow of PG familiarity. It was like any Disney movie of the week, with haystacks and wisecracks and plaid shirts and a jaded but lovable good old boy ready for redemption and a montage at the hands of those crafty but warm-hearted orphans on the day of the big race. There seemed very little likelihood of anything offensive happening beyond possibly the title song performed live in a bar scene by its author. Then, about 10 minutes in, something happened that nobody could have predicted. It was Kenny's first scene with the orphans. He was rescuing them from a river, don't ask, when the little one, the most mischievous one, turned to his bedraggled rescuer and said, "Mister, you look like shit." It was like we'd hit a roo. But no one could say anything because this was the movie they'd settled on. This was the one they were going to have to stick with no matter what. And besides, perhaps it was a one-off or a mistake. In 1986, South Park was still a decade away, and in movies, children didn't say things like, "You look like shit." Or, "Holy shit, holy shit, ass, bastard, chicken shit, holy shit, son of a bitch, no shit, Dick Tracy, and holy shit," all of which quickly followed in the initial shit's disgraceful wake. This was the most foul-mouthed moppet in the history of cinema. Even Kenny was powerless to stop him, although he didn't seem to notice it till around the 70-minute mark, and even then he earned a pointed chicken shit for his trouble. It was around here that Les Mackey announced to the bus, "I hope you're f***ing happy, Martin," thus instantly upping the swearing ante and undoing what little work Kenny's misty-lensed final act change of heart was doing to stem the torrent of infant-generated abuse.
"Only the Kenny Rogers one, chicken shit, sounds fit for family viewing, ass."
As the end credits rolled and the real Kenny Rogers belted out another reason not to buy the soundtrack album to Six Pack, the bus fell silent. Nobody said anything for several dark kilometres. The evening had been ruined, and it was all that guy up the front's fault. When we were awoken, around 4 in the morning... Les had been replaced by the other driver, fresh out of the packet and unaware of the six-pack affair. He announced to the semi-comatose crowd that we would be stopping for breakfast at the finest breakfast restaurant in all of Dubbo. Like zombies after a big night on the tear, we shambled into the blindingly bright aquamarine breakfasting area of a restaurant that seemed to be constructed entirely from aquariums. We were about to chow down on breakfast at 4 in the morning amid dazzlingly lit denizens of the deep in Dubbo. It was like we were dreaming breakfast. No one was saying anything, but as I queued for plastic cutlery, I began to sense a distance from the other passengers that was something more than the haze of interrupted sleep. I'd only been trying to help, and now no one wanted to sit with me. As I huddled over my dishwasher hot bowl of cold milk and rice bubbles and shimmering reflected fish shapes danced across my empty table for 10, I recalled the words of a man who had once said, "You've got to know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em, know when to walk away, and know when to run."